anyone can make a change. The fear they have the will.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of AHA Presents About Education. I'm Neil Kreisel and I'm your host every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 10, and on Saturdays at 4. We're brought to you by Montecito Bank and Trust, proudly serving our communities and their financial needs for over 40 years. Pierre LaFon, Wendy Foster, offering fine clothes, good food, and vintage wines. CSU Channel Islands, no matter which of their academic programs you choose, you will be at the center of your educational experience. And Sansum Clinic, whose multi-specialty team of medical professionals have been providing quality care to you and your family for 98 years. And we're here today with Brian Hare, a professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke University. Thank you so much for being here, Brian.
Neil, it's a real pleasure. I'm looking forward to talking to you.
Well, I'm really looking forward to talking to you because I have three grandchildren, and my screensaver on my iPhone are my three dogs. So that just tells you where my focus is.
So you mean you have grand dogs?
I've had dogs my whole life, and I guess this is not the right time to ask this question, but how come they sleep under the blankets with me? And they're big.
Well, I can give you a really funny science answer to that.
Okay.
Which it's because of the use of pesticides that kill fleas and ticks.
So that's why they sleep under the blankets.
Yeah, it's another way to answer that question because you know, I don't think a lot of people think about the importance of you know, the ability to get rid of pests or parasites in creating the new relationship, or I should say renewing this tight relationship we have with our dogs, where they actually come into our bed and sleep with us at night. Because I think, you know, part of the reason dogs were not in beds and were not even in the house was because of parasites.
Right. So for those of you who listening that aren't totally up to date on evolutionary anthropology, can you just give us a quick statement as to what that subject entails?
It's just a study of everything that has to do with human biology, but we take an evolutionary perspective. So we look at how humans evolved and how that then informs anything about our species. It could be anything from how we think to how we walk to what we eat, how we, you know, raise our kids, etc.
So at in North Carolina, at Duke University where you're at, you're allowed to use the word evolutionary?
We can get away with it. Yeah, we can get away with it sometimes.
Well, that's good. So I guess part of your, or a good part of your study is looking at the cognitive similarities between humans and animals.
That's right. So I am very interested in the question of how human cognition evolved. That's sort of my specialty within evolutionary anthropology. And one of the things that is important to answering questions about cognitive evolution or the evolution in human intelligence is understanding how we are different from other animals. And in many ways, in trying to figure out what's unique that might allow for culture language, we end up uncovering similarities that we didn't know were there, that often people had thought were big differences.
And the evolutionary chain of the human species doesn't overlap with dogs and animals, yet you're saying that it's still important to understand how they evolved?
Well, funny enough, it ends up that rats and mice are more closely related evolutionarily than dogs are to humans. So, you know, rabbits, rodents are much closer relatives to us than our dogs are. So your point is well made. Well, why? What in the world could dogs tell us about ourselves if they're so distantly related? And the reason is because I told you the first step is sort of trying to figure out what's the same or what's different about ourselves from other animals. And we spend a lot of time working, and I have too, working with bonobos and chimpanzees, our two closest living relatives, and we discover, oh, wow, in many ways they're more like us than we knew, or, oh, you know, they can't solve problems, and that is something that may make our species different and account for language, culture, et cetera, things we'd like to explain. But once we identify the things that might make us different, where dogs play a huge role, is the big challenge that Darwin gives us in thinking about human evolution. Is, okay, these are the things that are different, but how did they happen? What was the process by which they evolved? And that's the unique role that dogs have started to play, because they are domesticated, and the process of becoming domesticated and understanding and revealing what that is has started to tell us a lot about what may have happened in our own species evolution.
So I take it part of your study is looking at wolves also, because that's where it began?
Exactly. We have spent a lot of time working with wolves as well. In fact, we've just wrapped up a study in Minnesota.
So, you know, let me see if I can pronounce this word, anthropomorphize. That's a sort of something that dog lovers like me sometimes get accused of. You know, when my dog is overheated, he's smiling because his mouth is curved and he's looking for air, and I think I just think he's happy.
Right.
And, you know, if you go on the web, there are people that say they can read what the dog's facial expressions are. Is that not of any scientific value?
So I think people can take it to an extreme in either direction, thinking that you know, dogs or other animals are just like us, and that can lead to problems. And your example is a really good one, where there's something that the dog is trying to communicate, or you could read from their facial expression that actually means they're not happy, or maybe they need water, or they need to stop, or they're anxious. And you think that they're happy, and that would be a problem. But there's the other extreme too, which is that being anthropomorphic can tell us nothing about animals, and that's not true. In fact, you know, taking an anthropomorphic approach has been very powerful in studying animal intelligence, animal cognition, in an experimental context where you're generating ideas or hypotheses about how animals might think. And often we're using the literature on human infants to inform our ideas. You can't get more anthropomorphic than that, but the question is, which human are you talking about? And when you start talking about infants, they actually have a lot in common with animal psychology. And so if you're using ideas about how babies are thinking and what babies are doing to then generate ideas to test about how animals think, that's actually been a very powerful method to reveal some of the complexities and sophistication that is not often apparent in different animals.
You know, speaking of babies, there's been a lot of neurological research over the last 5 to 10 years understanding, you know, 0 to 2 education, and it's scientifically driven, not just by observation, but there's all types of, you know, of computerized
interfaces
with the brain,
right?
And they're telling, you know, the scientists and parents that this is a really important part of a child's development. Could that be helpful looking at animals too, looking at their brain and their reaction when we think they're smiling? What's firing up in their brain?
Well, it can be, but it's not, you know, it's not as powerful as one might think at first, because ultimately, all the behavior going on in different neurons and networks of neurons in the brain, the interpretation of what it's responsible for in terms of your behavior ultimately depends on being able to measure behavior. And so you can see that in one species, neurons and networks of neurons work in one way, and that's related to a type of behavior. And then you can make an inference about another species just based on the similar neural activity. But you couldn't just look at the brain of an organism without having any idea about its behavior and really make any inference at all. It would be very, very difficult. So really, it's you have to understand behavior to understand the brain. And then once you get that knowledge, you can then start making inferences about other brains.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, using innovative social-emotional learning and character building to help teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Brian Hare, professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke University. And we could be talking about the basketball team, but I think that's still early in the season, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So when we look at the fact that we have domesticated a dog, and we're going to get to that in a minute, what about all those YouTube videos that we see where people have domesticated everything? I mean, there's people, and it's probably irresponsible, but you see someone with a pet lion, someone with a pet whatever, that video where the person's brought up a lion and then he went back or a gorilla, and he goes back 3 years later and the gorilla remembers him. Does that mean that dogs were domesticated, but other animals could have been also?
So that is such a deep question, and I love it. It's sort of an innocent question that lots of people would want to ask and answer. And the reason I call it deep is because I could literally give you a two-hour lecture on different parts of what you just said. So let me not do that and just make a quick distinction, which is that you were calling everything domestication if an animal is interacting with a person. And I would like to make a distinction between an animal that is tame, and that's a wild animal that has the biology of a wild animal that has been raised by a person or with people. I'd like to call that tame. And then I would like to call domesticated animals an animal that has over many generations evolved and has actually changed biologically. Their DNA literally is different after 20 generations than it was at the very beginning in the first generation due to their interaction with humans, and that change in their genetic makeup leads to different behavior, morphology. Those are domesticated animals.
And does this evolution, where you say the genes are changed, is that, you know, the survival of the fittest? Dogs that bit people would then be euthanized, and the dogs that didn't bite people would be given food. Is that sort of the way the genes changed in terms of survival of the fittest?
So there's been a great question again. So there's been a lot of ideas about, and Darwin actually, in The Origin of Species, had a whole chapter on domestication that informed his thinking about how natural selection worked. He also wrote two giant monographs on domestication. And I just bring those up as points that thinking about domestication has been a very powerful way to think about natural selection and evolution more generally. And that means people have been very interested in figuring out, well, what causes domestication? We know that domesticated animals are different than the species they evolved from, but what is the process that led them to be that way? Our dogs have curly tails and floppy ears, and like you say, they bite or they don't bite, and they bark, etc. Did they get all those traits because somebody decided a floppy-eared dog would be really interesting, and so they selected floppy-eared dogs, or did they select for biting, or did they select for speed? Were people individually selecting all these different traits? And it ends up the answer seems to be probably in the very, very beginning, humans had very little to do with the process of wolves becoming domesticated to dogs other than just being around and interacting with dogs. And the story isn't a story of survival of the fittest the way that people often in the public mind think of survival of the fittest, meaning the big, strong, superior, as a lot of people like to characterize it, being the one with the advantage. Instead, the story of dogs is one of survival of the friendliest. So wolves, who were able to approach and be non-aggressive and not fearful in their interactions with humans, were at an advantage. And we know now that that's the process that drove the evolution of dogs. So I can tell you the details of how we figure that out, and it has to do with an experiment in Siberia. But I want to see, what do you think of that so far?
Well, yeah, I mean, but it does beg one question, which is, let's go back, thousands and thousands of years ago, where cavemen probably thought of animals as either food or something to be afraid of. Why, you know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Did the dogs get friendly enough so the caveman was not worried, or was the caveman for some reason perceiving that the dog could be friendly? I would have thought that the caveman would never have let the dog into his life, given his prejudice against animals.
So let me tell you that. So I'm going to come back to that in a roundabout way and tell you, first of all, I'm going to give you a fact and a story. So the fact is that we know that dogs began evolving from wolves 20 to 40,000 years ago. So that's at least 5 to 10,000 years before the first crop was ever sown. So what I'm trying to say with this fact is there was no agriculture and there was no society using agriculture when dogs began to be domesticated. That means that it's hunter-gatherers and interactions with foraging populations that led to the evolution of our best friend, at least drove the initial evolution. So that's the fact. The story is the story of trying to understand, well, how could that have happened? And there was an experiment in Siberia that was done with foxes. The foxes were selected, and now it's in its almost 60th year of being carried out. There were two populations. One population of foxes was selected literally for one thing and for 60 years. And that one thing was friendliness towards people. They would take foxes that they would interact with the foxes in a very specific way, and they would choose the foxes that were the nicest, would like to approach and like to play with people, never bit, all that kind of stuff, and they would breed those foxes together with each other. They then kept a control line, and the control line they kept in absolutely identical way to the foxes they were breeding to be friendly, but they didn't select them for breeding based on how they interacted with people. They just bred them randomly on that trait. So then, fast forward, after they begin this experiment 20 generations, and today it's even more extreme, the population that was selected to be friendly towards people, well, no surprise, they love to be with people. In fact, they want to interact with people. They're super attracted to humans. The control population is still a population that if you try to touch them, they will bite you or they will, you know, want to run away. Well, guess what else happened, though? They did not select, again, for anything but friendliness, but the experimental line, the line that they selected to be friendly, they have a high prevalence of curly tails, floppy ears, they have multicolored coats, they have much smaller noses, their teeth are really crowded, their teeth have actually gotten smaller, and there are all sorts of physiological changes in the systems in their bodies that are responsible for stress responses. The control population has none of these changes, and it's all due to one selection pressure, which was for being friendly. So what I'm trying to get at is a lot of the differences we see between wolves and dogs can be explained because of the fox experiment due to selection for friendliness. So back to my foraging friends who somehow we think were interacting with initial proto-dogs or the first group of wolves who decided to start interacting with people, and they were at an advantage for being less aggressive and not fearful of people, and we think that that same process we see in the foxes occurred in a group of wolves that then led to all the types of changes we see in dogs, so floppy ears, curly tails, friendlier behavior, being attracted to people, and you've got the evolution of dogs kickstarted.
So if you could identify these characteristics with a human and sell it to people who are about to get married, you would be the most famous person in the world. People would say, this is my second marriage. I want someone really friendly. What should she look like? Does she have curly hair? Does she have small ears? Okay, so much for humor. I think it's time to take a break. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, improving attitude, creating social harmony, bridging the achievement gap for teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Brian Hare, professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke University. And before the break, we were talking about certain characteristics that make dogs particularly attractive to people. And, you know, one of the things that I think is a mutual trait for both the dog and the owner is trust. And what's amazing about dogs is that all my dogs are rescue dogs. And when I first get them, they're nipping at me, they're scared of me, and now they sleep in bed with me. So there's this ability to form bonds with people, and people can then form bonds with a dog that initially has some issues. So that's an interesting sort of phenomenon.
Yeah, so we actually did an experiment where we were trying to understand. I work with a lot of different animals, and dogs are included. And there's a lot of work. Say, I've done work with bonobos and chimpanzees, where chimpanzees are really xenophobic. They're scared of strangers. And I worked with bonobos, who are very xenophilic. They actually are attracted to strangers. And so we were really curious about dogs, and especially dogs compared to wolves. And so we developed a study where we wanted to see not are dogs more curious or interested in their owner, say, than a stranger. We'd already shown that they were sort of more likely to want to be near their owner, and actually more likely to listen and trust the communicative information their owner gave them, which isn't surprising to anybody who lives with a dog. But what we were curious about is what happens if it's two strangers, and now you've got one stranger they've had some kind of interaction with, where, you know, maybe the dog, you know, pet them or hug them for 15 minutes, and another stranger who's a complete stranger, the person that the dog's never seen before, would they have some kind of preference? And certainly, after 15 minutes of somebody being nice, surely they would, you know, trust that person over the other stranger. And the answer was, and we did three studies, and we tested a bajillion pet dogs, and there is just absolutely no difference in how they treat the different strangers. Having a short interaction with a dog is not enough to make them trust you more than any other stranger.
So it
takes time to build the relationship, and it really is a bond, is what I'm getting at.
And that's really important, because one of the things that has been very important for whether it's children with autism or people with disabilities like a seizure disorder is to create a bond between one dog and one person. In fact, a documentary I just saw a few months ago was where they trained these dogs were very clear that they didn't want other members of the family to bond with the dog. They felt that the dog really needed to bond just with one person, not more than one, in order to be really effective. Is that being overly cautious, or is there something biological about that?
Well, I don't think we know. That's a very difficult thing to study. Is it that dogs that bond with just the person they're helping versus a dog that bonds with, say, everyone in the family, is one more effective at their job than the other? When I say we don't know that, what I mean is from a scientific perspective, if you ask me a question like that, I have to think, have I seen a study in the scientific literature where one group of dogs that had bonded with just one person was compared in their performance to dogs that had bonded with everyone in the family, and that one group was somehow outperforming the other? I've never seen a study like that. I've never heard of anybody examining that, but it's an important question, and I don't know the answer, but I would suspect that if you were going to ask me, you know, well, put your cards down, where would you put your money? My guess is that being bonded with the family is fine, and the dog's still going to do a good job as long as they're bonded with the person they have to help, and there's somebody there, you know, to make sure that the dog is attending to that person. But I'm sure there are people who will disagree with me, and that's fine, and that's one of our jobs when we do science, is we're trying to take disagreements, figure out ways to move it from just arguing to, are there ways that we could test and find out what actually is going on, because everybody is going to benefit, and who cares who's right? Let's just figure out how the truth works.
So someone who has autism is having difficulty connecting to other people, and then there are, you know, examples of that person with autism connecting to an animal. Does that mean something that we should be looking at?
That's Well, one of the ideas about why that's happening is why would it be that people in the autism spectrum disorder, why if they're on the spectrum, if they're having a hard time interacting with humans, why is it that they're reported having a better time if they have somehow bonded with a dog? One of the arguments is that dogs, because they're sort of accepting of everyone and they can bond and they can love any human, despite behaviors that may make it hard for some people to bond. The person with autism actually, in the interaction with a dog, may be receiving the type of interaction that increases the hormone in their body called oxytocin. It's this social bonding hormone that is responsible for parents bonding with their offspring or with their kids in our case, in our species case. And that same neural hormone is responsible for bonding between unrelated individuals as well. The hypothesis or the idea has been that, well, maybe that's what's happening with dogs. As they're interacting with autistic children, it's creating a level of oxytocin that they don't experience otherwise. And that's then what's allowing the autistic kids to have better social interactions, because it makes them basically more interested in interacting with individuals they might not be as familiar with. It helps them bond with the dog and potentially even other people. And that's an active area of research.
And I guess that's something that can be studied. You can just check the oxytocin level during the playtime or whatever.
That is exactly what people have been trying to explore.
So you have been on various documentaries. In fact, when I saw your picture, I realized I actually saw you on TV a few years ago. you're doing work that has gotten a lot of attention. You were here in town at UCSB last year with The Genius of Dogs. Can you tell us what that is, The Genius of Dogs?
Well, first of all, it was awesome. I was a Sage Fellow, and I got—I was hosted by Mike Gazzaniga's group at UCSB, and had a wonderful time. I got to give three lectures at the university, one of which was called "The Genius of Dogs," which is the name of my book that I wrote with my wife. And that book is all about thinking about animal intelligence from an evolutionary perspective and how that gives you new insight on how we think about genius. And dogs are the absolute celebrity in this cause, because a species that even scientists thought was completely unremarkable and uninteresting, if you take an evolutionary perspective and you ask, okay, so given that we think they're so unremarkable, how can you explain that there's 100 million of them and that they're really one of the most successful mammals on the planet? And how do you explain that they evolved from an animal that sadly, because I work with them and they're wonderful, but they're sadly near extinction, and those are wolves? So whatever it is that allowed this animal to evolve such that it went from a form that is nearly extinct to now is ubiquitous and is everywhere where humans are, that is genius. And it ends up that their psychology is a big part of the story. And we touched on it when we talked about the oxytocin story. And there's more to that story as well, because one of the things that we've discovered is that they are more like us psychologically when we're talking about social problem-solving abilities than our closest ape relatives, bonobos and chimpanzees, in some really important ways.
How do you get the book? Is it available on Amazon?
Yes, it is anywhere where books are sold.
Okay, and it's called The Genius of Dogs. It sounds like it's really be a fun read.
It is fun. It's really the story of how dogs happened and why they're able to communicate and cooperate with us in a way that other species can't. And it's because they have evolved skills that are very much like the skills that human infants have as they are beginning to participate in culture. So some of the same cognitive abilities that we all relied on as we first started to interact with other humans and learn from them, dogs have those same abilities, but chimpanzees and bonobos do not.
Wow, interesting. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA helps teens achieve goals, surmount challenges, stop bullying, and communicate and listen effectively. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here with Brian Hare, professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke University. So tell us about a little bit about yourself. Where were you born and raised?
Well, I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and part of what inspired a lot of my work with animals was having a pet dog, just like you were talking about your three dogs sleeping in your bed and on your screen and a big part of your social life. You know, my best friend growing up was my Labrador Retriever, and we went everywhere together. So I was always looking in his eyes and wondering, what are you thinking, big guy? So I think that's partly what had me ended up doing what I do.
So speaking of eyes, I read somewhere that when you're talking to your dog, you should look at his left eye as opposed to his right eye, or the other way around. But there is a cognizant difference for a dog depending upon which eye you're looking at. Is that an old wives' tale?
I have no idea. You have stumped me on that one. That doesn't happen very often, but I have not heard that before. What I can tell you is that when you make a lot of times people have been worried that making eye contact with dogs is a threat signal, and that wolves, for instance, stare at each other as a threat and part of dominance displays. And yes, if you're yelling at your dog and you're not being nice to your dog, then yes, staring at them would be a threat. But normally, if you're just hugging on your dog and you're, you know, having a nice interaction with them, making eye contact is actually just about the best thing you can do, because we know now, and it's been measured and demonstrated, that it creates oxytocin, that neurohormone I was telling you that leads to bonding. It creates it in you and in your dog. And it's partly why we feel so much love. And, you know, the short version of this is dogs, when they're staring at you, they're not really asking, oh, give me your sandwich, or, you know, I want whatever food it is you have. They're trying to hug you with their eyes.
So you mentioned the Siberian experiment, and I think that was a documentary as well. And I've seen a couple of documentaries in Eastern European countries of dog studies. Is that just coincidence, or for some reason are unlikely countries that are not particularly rich and are, you know, in Eastern Europe interested in studying animals versus what happens in developed countries like ours?
Well, I think one of the revolutions that's happened is, I mean, even in the United States, there you would think if you watch television that there's tons of work going on, you know, focused on animal psychology, animal intelligence, you know, the topic of the interview. But actually, there's just a handful of people who have the ability to do this now, because there's so little funding, even in the United States. And so dogs have been sort of a revolution, because even here, where there are meager resources for this type of work, you can answer a whole host of questions that are really important to understanding animals more generally, dogs specifically, and how we can improve dogs' ability to do all the different jobs they do, which is one of the things we do, you know, whether it's finding bombs or helping people that are disabled. And then it also, dogs have a lot to tell us about ourselves. So I think the Eastern Europeans, Russians, and really every continent where you find dogs, there are researchers working on dogs, whether it's in Africa, Australia, Europe, Asia. I have colleagues on all continents.
So I don't want to get political, but do you think it's interesting that Trump is the only president that doesn't have a dog? All right, we'll just move on from that.
that is a fact, I've been asked to comment on that on multiple occasions, and my comment is always the same, which is, people who enjoy and like dogs should have them as pets, and those who don't should not.
Well, that sounds like someone that is always looking for research grants.
Just being diplomatic.
Yeah. So you did research at Harvard, and you did it at this for this type of study as well. How did you get Harvard to get involved, to get interested in this?
Well, I did my PhD at Harvard, so it was a funny story. My PhD advisor was one of Jane Goodall's star students. His name is Richard Wrangham, and he is a fabulous scientist and wrote Catching Fire, which is a fantastic book about human evolution and how cooking changed our species trajectory. And he studies wild chimpanzees, so why in the world would he have a graduate student who studies Siberian foxes? Well, he, being a polymath, just interested in everything, when he figured out that as an undergraduate I was already sort of working on this, he got really excited about it and encouraged me to keep going. And when we got the opportunity to go to Russia, he told me, you know, without a hesitation, I should do it. And I was the first non-Russian to ever collect data and publish that data on the Siberian fox experiment.
Wow. The students that take your course, are they limited to anthropology students? Or, I mean, if I was at Duke, I would love to take your course. But do you allow students in who are not anthropology majors?
I strongly encourage it. And we love freshmen too. And I have I work with lots of freshmen, and I have everything from computer scientists to engineers to people studying economics. Because what we do is really focus on human nature, and I don't know what that's not relevant to. You know, maybe if you're a physicist, but anybody else who has any future in something that has to do with humans and human behavior, understanding a little bit better human nature is going to help you.
Well, I like to go a step further. I think, you know, one of the problems in this country politically now is a lack of empathy. And, you know, one of the questions that people ask is, can you build empathy in people that are not empathetic? And I think that one of the ways to do that is through having a dog or a cat or some type of pet that you can feel comfortable showing love to and getting love in return. So I think there's a societal benefit for people to understand and to have animals, because maybe one of the ways we can create a society that's less tribal and more empathetic is to have more people with animals and more people sleeping in bed with their animals than shooting them.
Well, I think that's awesome, because I think, you know, everybody is thinking about that question is, you know, how can we sort of emphasize how we're more similar and stop emphasizing the differences? And, you know, people have people like to call it tribalism. Just to share with you one fun anthropology thing. I think there's evidence that there was in-group, out-group interactions before the first tribe. So a tribe is actually defined as a group of people organized around a chief or a group with a hierarchy. But before agriculture, the thinking is there were not many societies that were living as foragers that had a chief. So typically, hunter-gatherer foraging groups are just called bands, not tribes. So I actually, and it's sort of a small, you know, it seems esoteric point, but I think it's really important because tribalism is not something that is new in our species. It is actually very, very ancient. So this is one of those things where understanding human nature, I think, can inform our solutions. So I like you, have been very worried about this, and I like your idea about interacting with pets. And I would just add to that slightly and say, and we have been looking at that, and we have, and I can share quickly with you some of the things we found, but it ends up that how we view each other is very much strongly related to how we view animals. So in that way, I think what we're finding agrees with your idea. And the only interesting note I would put on, you know, the direction you were suggesting going is that because, you know, well, it's just for short, since everybody calls it tribalism, since tribalism is millions of years old, not even thousands of years old, but millions of years old, I don't think that empathy is the whole story. Because there's in-group, out-group hostility before there's human empathy, first of all. And then second of all, more empathy in humans is actually related often to more out-group hostility. So it's actually not always good to have more empathy, because by loving a group so much, you can often then use that as an excuse to do horrible things to another group. So the diagnosis that we have is really, it is related to how humans view animals, but empathy is sort of a byproduct. It's not the center of the story.
Yeah, and one word we could use to sum up what you were saying could be called nationalism, which we're seeing all over the world now, where the anti-empathy is the fact that people now feel an alliance to, if it's not their tribe, it's to their country or to their group of people, and this overripe, excessive dedication to their country or what they think is their country sometimes becomes very divisive. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and believe it or not, we'll be right back with our final segment. Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA helps teens manage their emotions, support their peers, and serve their community. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Brian Hare, Professor of Evolutionary Anthropology at Duke University. You can't hear the sponsor's messages, but one of our sponsors is CSU Channel Islands, which is a Cal State University out here that has under its wing Santa Rosa Island, which is one of the Channel Islands that has had human life there for like 10,000 years, and Chumash Indian burial sites. And so the anthropology department has become a major factor in managing that island. And I've been there a few times, and I'm really surprised that anthropologists have now become rock stars because they do such a good job there. So, and it's one of the really important departments at CSUCI. I just wanted to put that plug in for one of our sponsors.
I love it. And the neat thing about those islands is that there's some evidence that the channel foxes may be sort of examples of this process we were talking about dog evolution, where there may have been selection similar to what we see in the foxes in the experiment occurring with the Channel Island foxes that has led them to be a little bit less timid towards people, maybe even interested in them, and they have sort of these cute traits that we see at the beginning of the process of domestication.
So before we run out of time, just tell, what is dognition?
Well, dognition is your chance to go learn about your dog. You can play a lot of the same games we play here at Duke with dogs to assess how they think. And they're based on games that were developed to understand which dogs were the best at finding bombs or at helping people with disabilities. But we walk you through the instructions, and there's videos as well. And you get to play a whole bunch of intelligence games, personality assessments, and the really unique feature is that when you're done, your dog is compared to all the other dogs that are in our database. Many people say, oh, my dog's too smart, or my dog isn't smart enough to play games like that. Why would I do that with my dog? And the answer when people say, oh, my dog is so smart, or my dog is not so smart, I say, well, compared to what? And that's what Dognition does, is it allows you to compare your dog to other dogs. What happens universally is people play these games, and they're shocked because things they thought their dog could do, they may not be able to do, and things that they thought there's no way their dog would be able to do, they're like, oh my gosh, I couldn't believe that he could do that. I look at him completely differently. There's somebody sleeping in my bed I didn't know as well as I thought I did.
So how do you get this application?
You just go and you you just go to dognition.com and you sign up.
And this is your website?
Yeah, it's a citizen science project, and by participating, you get to learn about your own dog, and you're helping us because we're starting to publish. We just published our second peer-reviewed scientific paper, and we're about to submit our third and fourth one. And so, by participating, you get to learn about your dog, but then all the data then gets used so we can make discoveries that we couldn't make otherwise.
And do you have online courses for non-matriculated students?
I do. I have if you just Google dog cognition and emotion, I have a Coursera course. It's free to take.
Well, you know, thank you so much for not only being on the show today, but for all you do. And next time you're in Santa Barbara, I'd like to introduce you to my dogs and have a conversation with them. They're Weimaraners, and I know that we didn't get a chance to talk about the fact that you studied in Germany. and so maybe you can speak German to them, and maybe they listen to you more than they listen to me.
I love it. Okay, well, anyway, I look forward to doing it.
Thank you, Brian. It was terrific. And thank you all for listening to AHA Presents About Education, and we'll see you next week.